Hi, it's Victor Perton, that optimism man, and today I have one of my rock star leaders in the study of optimism and hope joining us. Carol Graham is the Leo Pasvolsky Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution, College Park Professor at the University of Maryland, and a Gallup Senior Scientist. Her groundbreaking work on happiness, well-being, poverty, and wealth and inequality is superb. Her books are well worth reading. Her most recent, The Power of Hope, How Wellbeing Science Can Save Us from Despair, and her other books like Happiness Around the World, The Paradox of Happy Peasants and Miserable Millionaires, and The Pursuit of Happiness, An Economy of Wellbeing. Carol has significantly advanced our understanding of how wealth and poverty, optimism and hope and aspiration shape our happiness. And Carol's research inspires and influences global discussions on well-being and the pursuit of a brighter future. Carol Graham, welcome. You are my rock star on optimism and hope. And as you know, when you visit the Center for Optimism, the first question we ask everyone, even as someone as distinguished as you, what makes you optimistic, Carol? Is it life experience? Is it faith? Is it mindset?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me on, Victor, and I appreciate your work. I think it's not faith, and I don't want to dismiss faith, but I personally come from a very Catholic family, and I just don't believe God will take care of it, but I applaud people who do. And I certainly believe in the spirituality of human beings, and that plays a role in being able to think beyond yourself. And I think in a weird way, that kind of dovetails with, whether you want to call it optimism or hope or both concepts, you kind of have to believe in something beyond your day-to-day life, right? Which for hopeful people and optimistic people, it tends to be not, you know, their future, but also that of others. But I think in my research and in terms of the traits, so it's kind of different what you feel like, you know, emotionally. But, and I think emotions are part of the whole story. But I think for research and trying to define the concept and how if it leads to, you know, better outcomes, I think then you have to think about it as a mindset. You know, it requires not just thinking that things will get better. It requires some determination that you can make them better. Some people call that grit. Some people call that, you know, a whole bunch of different terms. But I think, you know, when I think about hope and optimism, I think hope is slightly distinct in that it is more focused on agency and, you know, determination to achieve aspirations. And yet, as you know, we've discussed before, you can't have one without the other. I mean, hope, you may need, it's probably good to be a little bit skeptical, but you need some optimism to keep it all going, right? Because there are times that things don't work out. And we all know as we get older, that happens a lot. But then there are times they do, right? So I don't know if that's a good answer, but that's where I would put it.
Oh, I think it's a brilliant answer. It's reflective and it reflects your lifetime of research. I often quote Mother Julian of Norwich, you know, who lived through the Black Plague, who said, "All shall be well, all shall be well, all manner of things shall be well." And I think if she lived today, she'd probably be a professor of optimism too.
Yeah, to think that today, I think you need to be very optimistic.
You do. Now, look, I was first drawn to your writings with a comment in an essay you wrote where you said the link between optimism and longevity is strong. So before I ask you about longevity, can I ask you what drew you to the study of optimism and hope?
Well, a kind of windy road, but with very connected pieces. So I started off as a development economist. I'm from Peru originally, part Peruvian, part American, part Swiss, a bit of a mess, a good mess. But I grew up, my dad was a professor of medicine and public health at Johns Hopkins, and he had an institute for malnourished infants in Peru, and I grew up going there, and then I ended up doing my PhD dissertation on the coping strategies of the poor during hyperinflation and terrorism, and just, and really poor people, dirt floors. And I was struck always at both how gracious these people were. Like, they had no money, but if you went to interview them, they'd send out the kid, to the bodega down the street to get you, to buy you something to drink, which you didn't need, but it was like amazing. But also how hopeful they were and optimistic. And I'm not sure which it really was. I mean, they certainly were optimistic in the sense that things had to get better than they were in terms of how they lived. But that struck me. But so did the really bad conditions they lived in and had to go through. But I guess even though I was doing mainly economics, the kind of that psychology sort of stuck with me as part of an important story of why people continued to get ahead in Peru despite a lot of obstacles. And in like the year 2000, I did surveys on a whim with a colleague in Peru who was president of the central bank at the time, but he really cared about poverty and kind of what worked. And we had 10 years of data of very volatile economic period. But what we found was that the poor had a lot of upward mobility, that they were coming out of poverty in, at very high rate, in part because of market reforms that were being criticized. But the critics always assumed the market was bad for the poor, as opposed to the barriers to the market were actually more harmful for the poor than anybody else. Anyway, so I thought, this is crazy. Everybody's saying things are bad, that globalization is bad for the poor, and these people are coming out of poverty like crazy. So I thought, let's go back and ask them how they think they've done. And we had 10 years of data, very volatile times, but we had a clear trajectory of how people had done economically. And half the people who'd done the best said things were very bad compared to the past. And half the people, most of the people who had no change at all said things were okay, or maybe better because they wanted to believe they were better. So I realized psychology was a big part of this story. And I was one of the few crazy economists to do something as radical as collaborate with psychologists and started the economics of happiness, economics of well-being. We were a small, merry lot. I was very lucky to be among a bunch of very distinguished people. Daniel Kahneman, who went on to get the Nobel Prize in econ, even though he's a psychologist. Richard Easterlin, who started the economics of happiness. George Akerlof, who won the Nobel Prize, a few years later too. And I was kind of just fell into this. I was very lucky to be at Brookings. So I spent most of the first 10 years of that exercise showing that people in poor countries, the determinants of happiness were exactly the same for people all over the world, the same in very poor countries as in very rich countries, which n had never been assumed to be true because nobody'd studied the developing countries. So over time, that's really what I worked on. And then I noticed that the US was an incredibly depressing place to come back to. And I always thought it was because being poor in a rich country is really tough, particularly the US that tends to stigmatize the poor and this very hard, individual work ethic. And, you work hard, you get ahead. So implicitly, if you fall behind and you're poor, you're a loser. And, people that got ahead thought that narrative was great, but there were a lot of people that didn't get ahead for lots of reasons. But I had no idea the deaths of despair were going on yet. I did a study comparing the hope differences between the poor and the rich in Latin America, which is a very unequal region, and in the US. And they were 20 times greater in the US. So the rich were much more likely to be hopeful about or optimistic about the future than the poor here, than the gap in Latin America. And I was like, what is going on? And then I delved a bit deeper, and I found that African Americans, you know, the traditionally marginalized, discriminated against group, were three times more optimistic than whites, particularly at the low income levels. And I, you know, I thought this was puzzling, but I repeated it, I recoded the data. And then Ann Case and Angus Deaton came out with their study of deaths of despair, driven by despair among low income, middle-aged whites. And I realized that the U.S. had a crisis of despair and deaths of despair that was pretty much not known about, that, you know, which only increased since the time I started. So I spent a lot of time working on despair, way too much time, but understanding that despair led to really bad life outcomes. And I thought, you know, I need to understand the other side of this story, because initially minorities were not in the deaths of despair and they were very hopeful and optimistic. So what's going on? And that's why we did a study, several different ones, but I think the quote comes from a study we looked at over time, a US panel survey. There are not very many, the panel study of income dynamics out of the university, I think it's Michigan, yes. Or is it Wisconsin? One of those two, irrelevant. But to see if people who reported, we found there was an optimism question in the survey, so we're very happy about that, because at that point, and still in the US, there are not many surveys that include any kind of well-being question. But so we exploited both being a panel and having an optimism survey, and people who had died in the panel, sort of depressing, but we were able to look at optimism and longevity, and we found a very, very strong link, controlling for all other, you know, racial, demographic, economic factors, that people who reported optimism, I think it was when they were about 20, were more likely to be alive when they were 75. And that was published in, I think, Journal of Economic Behavior and Organization. But it really struck me that that was such a contrasting story to the deaths of despair story I was looking at, that I thought I had to understand these channels better. And I also need to be working on the antidote to despair, because it's pretty depressing. And what I found was that psychiatrists, for example, say that hope is the first step towards recover from mental illness. Or Snyder's famous definition of hope, he was a psychiatrist or a psychologist, I don't remember, but his classic definition of hope was that it was having belief, you know, belief for the future, either positive belief about the future, but agency as well, and pathways to get there, that you needed all of them to be hopeful, which is goes back to our discussion about optimism and hope being slightly different. But anyway, so I was like, okay, there's some stuff written about it, but not much. And then the same psychiatrist who said that hope was the essential first step towards recovery from mental illness had not written anything about it or explored it or studied it in any serious way. It was, so it was sort of something that either existed or it didn't. And in working on deaths of despair and working with the different teams in the UK that have taken their work on well-being and their statistics into interventions to improve well-being, and a few, very few, but some people in the US, that they were actually strategies, ways to cultivate hope among communities, among people where it had been lost. And I guess most importantly, and probably the easiest thing to achieve, was to cultivate it among young people, right? Because they're the ones that have their whole life to live. And if they're not hopeful about the future, optimistic about the future, which unfortunately they are not now in the US, it's not good. So anyway, that's where I went from that link to trying to, what could we do about it? Could we cultivate it? And I'm not an activist in the sense, I'm glad there are activists, but I'm, you know, I try and study people and programs that work and achieve certain objectives, whether it be longevity, whether it be recovery from mental health, whether it just be, you know, good performance in school, which you need to have some sort of hope and aspirations to, you know, persist with.
I am the Dalai Lama, I think, replicating some of your thinking, said I was lucky enough to be in an audience with him a couple of years ago, and he said, the most important thing we can do for teenagers is to foster their optimism and hope. But you can't tell a teenager to be optimistic, you have to model it. And I think the OECD, you know, also influenced by you, says that optimism is the trait most closely associated with life satisfaction. And they, in fact, say that we should be teaching optimism explicitly in the school curriculum. So thinking about, you know, what you've written and, you know, when I think of Peru, for instance, I always think of this upbeat sort of society. I must confess, I'm always fueled by Pisco Sour when I'm there.
Well, that helps. So does the food. It's outrageously good.
Very, very similar, in fact, to Australian food, you know, that sort of fusion of different influences. So
yes.
How do you think, so thinking about public health and Australia, the United States and the other English-speaking countries seem to have fallen into this despair. And three other people that I found, so Michael Franti, the musician, says, I believe the greatest battle that's taking place in the world isn't between left and right. It's between cynicism and optimism. There are people who believe it's possible to create a better life and a better world. When we lose that sense of optimism, it's when we quit and when we give up. And I don't know if you watched the coronation of King Charles, but there was this sensational lady in a blue gown who carried the sword, the first time a woman had carried the sword. And she was Penny Mordaunt, and she lost her seat in the election. She was the leader of the House of Commons, but she said, the fault line in politics at the moment is not between left and right, but what we need between optimists and pessimists. We need optimists for the next tough shift. And then the president of Singapore, Tharman, says that this collapse of optimism in the Western world is the biggest public policy problem in the world. And he said, as you do, this sort of storm that you've got in the United States, and he observes it in Europe and elsewhere, we must create bases for optimism to see ourselves through this long storm and to emerge intact, emerge a better place, and it can be done. Now, I think all three of them, in some senses, mirror you. What do you think? How can we answer that challenge from Tharman that we actually make more optimism, more hope, the object of public policy?
It's a big question. First of all, I confess to not having watched the coronation, but I'm very happy to hear that story. So I think, you know, again, maybe I'm a bit of a nerdy economist here, but I think one way to do, I mean, you have to have rhetoric. You have to have effective rhetoric, which it turns out the Harris-Waltz campaign is doing very much with hope, as did Obama. And believe me, when people are in bad straits and somebody's telling them everything's falling apart versus you know, we can get ahead, we can do this. I think that's a good start for the political strategy, but I do think you have to have an actual policy strategy. And I've learned a lot by working with a team in the UK that has gone, I worked with a team in the US also, National Academy of panel, study on well-being metrics and policy, but it went nowhere because this country is so divided, and the right considers these things woke and all this stuff. It's crazy. But anyway, but in the UK, they actually implemented well-being metrics in their statistics in 2012. They had a rocky rollout. People didn't know what the hell was going on. Spent a lot of time with Gus O'Donnell, who was the political mind behind it all. Although he started as a brilliant econometrician, so he's an amazing guy, but very, he really understood that this needed to be communicated right to people or they wouldn't know what was going on. But now the metrics are in their treasury policy, in their, you know, cost benefit analysis, in their environmental policy. And so they can look at how different policies affect not just people's income or welfare in the traditional definition, but their well-being. And even the Leveling Up initiative, I don't know if you've heard about in the UK, which trying to address the big regional differences in the country. The central objective is not income inequality, although that's an objective, but it's well-being inequality, which is a much bigger concept. So it's that's I mean, I think one thing you need is both a commitment to policies being bigger, having bigger objectives or more broad objectives than just, increasing income equality or reducing racial discrimination. All those things matter, but having kind of an overarching layer, that's part of it. And part of it is measuring. What we measure is what matters. And when things are in national statistics, they, whether you agree that's good or not, they matter a lot more than when it's just a bunch of us nerdy academics using them, right? So in the UK, they now have HOPE in their national, in their battery of statistics. They added that. I have to say I had something to do with that. And the OECD is considering that in their, their measurement guidelines. It's very much on the table. So that serves a couple of roles. One is you need to understand trends before you know what policy should be doing or what your objective is. But two, it normalizes the concepts, right? It's like, oh, well, if the government measures it, it must be important. I mean, that's not, again, it's, but that's kind of the messaging, right? So that people don't think these are just pie in the sky concepts that we're talking about. And they're not. We have increasing evidence that these things matter, that emotions and traits matter to economic behavior. They matter to longevity. They matter to a whole host of, they matter to how people vote. And what is, in the current moment, that's really important, isn't it? So I think his challenge is a good one, right? And I think it's increasingly important for the young, because I think Australia has also experienced a similar decline. I have it's a paper in progress on hope and long-term outcomes in Australia based on the HILDA data. And we find very much that hope matters a lot to all kinds of long-term outcomes, as we expected, but it's so nice to have a long, over really big overtime data set like the HILDA. But we also found that in Australia, like the US, it's the old that are much more hopeful and optimistic than the young. And that is a change from, data analyses over time. There has been a shift. And, my own kids are just, I think they're all in good jobs or starting to be doctors or whatever they're doing. I obviously know what they're doing, but they think about things like our political polarization, the climate change that, half the US denies it exists. What kind of world are they going to be facing? The kind of antediluvian reversal of civil and other rights in the US, which is just hard to understand, and the kind of move towards extremist religion, and it's a tough world for young people now. And I think for older people it's not good either, but we know that we've gone through cycles before, right? And you eventually the tide turns. But I think the young need to be equipped with skills to deal with that. And the other thing they need to be equipped with is different skills to make it in tomorrow's labor markets, which are going to be very much about adaptability, creativity, service skills, having confidence, or at least displaying it, being able to communicate well. These are all skills that are not emphasized in public high schools in the US, right? We haven't had debating teams. They disappeared about 20 years ago. And those are great. That you can't be a good debater if you don't listen to both sides, right? So there's, I think all of those things are pointing in that same direction that would support why that mission is important.
Brilliant. And you referred to the OECD and, of course, young people. And, this collapse of optimism in the young, Australia, United States, elsewhere. The OECD's data on education has caused them to conclude optimism should be taught explicitly in the school curriculum, as it is the trait most closely associated with life satisfaction. So when you teach at a university level, but thinking about how you do that at school, and I think, I mean, I run workshops at schools and universities, but how would you implement it as a wider, broader deal with the problem of negativity, fear, anxiety, depression in the developed world?
Well, there's a wonderful example in the UK. I don't know if you've heard of it, the Be Well Initiative.
No.
It's in the Greater Manchester District Schools. So it's a deprived district and incorporated into middle and high school curriculum. So starting early, with the like buy-in from communities and parents, you know, so that it's not something imposed based on the surveys of the students in the Manchester districts themselves. They have now incorporated into mainstream curriculum, not tuitions. I've been thinking about college tuitions, I guess, which I'm not paying anymore, so I don't know why, but except they're unaffordable in the US, which does affect my work. But so that they're taught things like self-esteem, how to deal with bullies, how to deal with loneliness, socio-emotional skills, but just as part of the curriculum. They're not, you know, they're not sort of something else. It's just part of what you're learning. The Finns have a great program that starts in elementary schools to teach kids to identify misinformation, right? That is providing them with a tool they need, or they can believe all this doomsday stuff, right? They can understand. So there's some of that. There's a little bit of it in U.S. schools trying to teach flourishing. I like the British approach better. I think it's more effective. And then, you know, there are community colleges in the U.S. that try and provide a couple of things for low-income students that I think are starting to show up being duplicated in more community colleges. One is making sure everybody has a mentor, which helps in the case of needing mental health treatment or whatever it might be. They make it possible for community college students to take courses from four-year state universities right on the community college campus, so they don't have to move, which is expensive. They could have some young families, whatever it is. And they also, one in particular stands out, Macomb County Community College. It's a hot political hotbed outside Detroit in a pretty deprived neighborhood, divided between retired auto workers, a discriminated against African-American community, and new immigrants. You can imagine what that's like, right? So they also, as part of our whole package, they have what they call a legacy project, where they actually bring outside speakers. How I learned about it is I went there, but to speak, but it's amazing. And it's to sort of engage the community, which has traditionally been very divided, on a ground that's comfortable, you know, open discussions where people don't have to agree or disagree, you know, and that it also, the students come as well, the community college students, so that it's a sense that their community is not sort of a wasteland, that there are things that can be achieved there. And that they do, they exude that message very well. So I think there are really tangible ways to do this. We just have to get over thinking these are pie in the sky, you know, fluffy things. It turns out these things are going to matter. They matter already, but they're going to matter more and more in the future, as even the nature of jobs is changing dramatically.
I've just created a ChatGPT for the Commonwealth Heads of Government. And as you can imagine, it has a heavy optimism bias. But coming back to your original field of economics, the University of Sydney Business School published a study last week, crunching 20 years of OEC data, and they called it the optimism effect. And so it was called the optimism effect on country productivity and innovation activities. And it found optimism, particularly economic optimism, plays a pivotal role in increasing investment in research and development, enhancing productivity and innovation nationally. And so the examples they gave, for instance, Brazil, Peru, that notion of optimism is driving progress. So Does that really, reflect? I mean, going right back to you, back in your Peruvian days, and doing your PhD. I love
It reflects my
the optimism
Peruvian
effect.
Days. It reflects my Peruvian days. It reflects some research I've done and some really close colleagues of mine as well. Not so much on national productivity, but how, on individual productivity, which aggregates up, obviously. But starting with Peru, when I've studied poverty in other contexts, like Eastern Europe, former Soviet Union, or even Africa, I was amazed at how depressing it was. Just people were in despair, I think. And in Africa, there seemed to be no way out. That's changed a bit. But what you see in Peru is people hustling. They'll sell anything. They're out there selling, during beach season, they're selling beach toys in traffic, or, all the newspapers or whatever it is, but there's just this energy. And what we found in Peru was actually, people talk a lot about the informal sector being bad and the formal sector being better because you have structured jobs and benefits. Well, in Peru, there's national health insurance. It's not great, but whether you're formally or informally employed, you have it. But mainly it was the freedom and the kind of ability to take initiative and not just control your own schedule, which is really good if you're poor and you have kids, but it was just to start your own little business or whatever. And people, the job satisfaction in the informal sector was way higher than in the formal sector. And if you think about it, if you're at the bottom of the rung in some of these factory jobs, both in the US or context like Peru, you have a rigid schedule, you can have a crappy boss and your life is hell, right? Versus that if you're, maybe it's risky, but you have control over your own fate, which is part of being helpful, right? So there's that, I think, is part of it. Part of it, we did some work ages ago, 2012, I think, with a colleague of mine who's initially from Mongolia. She's great. She's at a business school, Loyola Business School in Baltimore. And we looked at, did firms invest more in happier places? And it turns out, guess what they did, particularly young startups. Now, what's driving that? Well, happier places tend to, there's a contagion effect. People are going to move there. Things are moving, and it's kind of, you don't really know if the place called the happy caused the happiness or the happiness improved the place. I mean, there's some wonderful work on cities by a colleague of mine called Richard Florida called The Creative Class. And it's the reason cities have very high levels of productivity in general is that they created people like a critical mass, right? And so I think our kind of happiness in firms work suggested that in those contexts, firms were more likely to take not crazy risk, but minor risk, invest in new stuff, and increase productivity. Completely different study, but by some really close colleagues of mine, Andrew Oswald at work and Eugenio Brotto, who's, I think he's in Scotland now, but he's originally from, he studied at Warwick with Andrew. But they did an experiment where people watched a film, and if the effect was to increase their optimism, they perform better at the experimental tests. So the kind of the optimism translated into effort. But it has the same channels have these implications for productivity, right? And you can imagine in a place like Sydney too, which is full of dynamism and, joie de vivre and gorgeous on top of it, but a lot of different activity, different culture, whatever, that's exactly the kind of place where that would hold, right? So increasingly, I think, we're finding that it's this kind of, happiness is, people, there's kind of like this, you can be happy without growth and no growth and all this. It's BS, actually, but it's honestly that happiness is part of a growth process, right? Because it's innovation. It's taking not risky, you know, risks like taking drugs, but it's take, you know, being able to step out of your, you know, mindset and try something new, which is key to productivity, right? So I you know, I totally agree. It accords with both my world experience and my research experience.
Brilliant. So maybe let's turn to America, if that's right, if you've still got time. In her acceptance speech for the Democratic nomination, Kamala Harris said this: "We must be worthy of this moment. It is now our turn to do what generations before us have done, guided by optimism and faith to fight for this country we love." You know, and I lived in the United States for a while. I just, with my daughter, we traveled across the Northeast and the Southwest. So I've regarded optimism as America's superpower, I mean, the lifeblood of its economy. Do you believe it is still America's strength?
Well, I think its decline is showing up as America's weakness, right? I mean, 4 kids are committing suicide and, you know, there's have a mental health crisis. It's not good, right? So I think, yes, I do think there was a very strong belief that you could do anything in America. And it has changed. And I think it's changed for really objective changes in circumstances and in attempts to roll back rights, to get rid of, you know, like affirmative action and admissions to colleges, in the sort of things that, you know, trying to turn back the kids, the DACA kids, who are the children of immigrants born in the U.S., they have no idea what another country is like. You know, threatening to kick them out. Now, obviously, the Biden administration has tried to reverse all that. And, you know, God forbid we have a return of Trump. That would really be a disaster. But, it, you know, even the verbiage that the Trump campaign uses, that doesn't just affect the optimism of migrants, but which I'm sure it does, but it affects the optimism of young people and of the kind of language is just absolutely abhorrent language and lack of respect for others' human dignity. I mean, that's not who our country is. I mean, we've had cycles of violence and discrimination forever. I'm not trying to glorify the US. It's kind of had its long list of problems. But there was this sense that you could get ahead, you know, if you worked hard. And Obama was kind of the, almost like the high point in that myth. And he was a great president. And then the backlash started before Obama. The kind of the Tea Party and all, just trying to restrict our political structures to kind of going back to the past and control by, you know, wealthy white men. It's had a negative impact in now taking away women's rights. You know, all those things are dismantling whatever composed our sense of possibility and hope and optimism. And, you know, I think Harris is speaking in the right terms and sort of saying, you know, she's had some criticism that she's not giving enough policy detail. Well, you know, you don't win elections based on policy detail, right? You win elections with effective messaging. And I think she and Waltz have done a great job of that. And I think the other thing that has been brilliant that I hope continues to work is, rather than being fearful of the stuff, you know, Trump and his goons are saying, is laughing at them. You know, Waltz had a great quote that I'm forgetting about how they wanted to take benefits away from kids and we want to put food in their bellies. So, I mean, that's just weird. Why would you think otherwise, right? And just kind of trying to make people think more optimistically. This stuff isn't that threatening. We just need to keep going and ignore it, right? Which is not 100% realistic, but I think as a political message, it's really important.
I think George Bush, who's no great fan of Trump, said that a president must be the optimist in chief. And if you think back to his predecessor, Clinton, and, you know, the music of Fleetwood Mac, Don't Stop Thinking About Tomorrow, and before him, Ronald Reagan and the like, you think of American presidents as being optimists rather than pessimists. And it's quite an extraordinary thing now that we can have pessimism or, you know, this negativity as the core of a campaign. Look, open on my desk is your wonderful book, The Power of Hope, How the Science of Wellbeing Can Save Us from Despair. And in that book, you say the need to address despair and to restore hope is critical to America's future. Now, I think you've been a big part of that, your knowledge and your understanding and the like. So how do you see, I mean, we've talked about it at length, but you're taking your book and turning it into action. How do you see that shaping the future of well-being in America and beyond?
I stick to the point that it's incredibly important that, you know, sort of COVID shown a huge, like, flashlight on all this stuff that, if, you know, we can say we're the fastest growing economy in the world, or we have these great, you know, productivity rates, and our stock market's booming, and our unemployment rate is low. Well, then why, when the unemployment rate is low, are 20% of prime age males out of the labor force? So they're no longer counted in the unemployment rate because you haven't looked for a job for 6 months. You're not in the ratio anymore, right? So we have these quote unquote great economic indicators coexisting with deaths of despair, with labor force dropout, with rising anxiety, depression among youth, even youth suicide. We have to deal with that side of the equation if we think our economy is going to continue to boom, right? And probably more important for the economy and for our society that our democracy survives, right? Because the economy is not going to survive if democracy doesn't. So, yeah, I think I stand by it being very important. I think getting there in this political climate and with the current context is going to take some doing. But I think I very much agree with the messaging of the Harris-Waltz campaign to kind of focus on, you know, restoring energy, confidence, hope, optimism, right, is really important, because if not, we're going to go to a context where, I mean, the messaging is already terrible, but also the record is terrible, where, you know, we're accusing falsely illegal migrants who happen to be legal, the Haitians that they're talking about, of eating pets and all sorts of things, or, you know, taking your jobs, or more crimes are committed, all these crimes being committed by people who come across the border. And yet the data show that immigrants have a much lower crime rate than Native Americans. But it's all, you know, it's all, if after a while falsehood becomes real, which is what these people wanted to do, it's going to be incredibly corrosive. So I think, yes, I hope we have a political context that allows for serious pursuit of some of these policies. I think the initial focus needs to be on our youth, but there are lots of policies to help, you know, displaced older workers do things like get out of isolation, volunteer in the community, kind of restore their life narrative, right? There's plenty out there to look at, but we need a context that allows people to do it, right? And so I think right now we've got a really important few weeks ahead, nail-biting few weeks, I have to say.
Yes, I, like you, I'm the son of refugees who came to Australia, and you know, you're Peruvian born. The evidence is, particularly in Australia, that migrants, the children of migrants, refugees, the children of migrants are much more optimistic personally and much more optimistic for the nation than native-born people. And so I, for one, you know, just I always say in my speeches at citizenship ceremonies and the like, each of these new citizens to Australia brings a sense of optimism, an opportunity that the country needs.
Yeah, I think you're right. They're just examples of things working. They'll start at the bottom and go right on up. And then we have, you know, some amazing like innovations in the US have been done by immigrants who started off as, you know, the guy that invented, sounds like a silly example, sriracha sauce, came, you know, he escaped Vietnam, you know, essentially in a boat, right? I mean, this is, and there's so many examples of that. People that all they need is to be let free and they can, their energy and their optimism starts to work, right? And so I think we've always been a nation of immigrants. But anyway.
There's an old book by Hobhouse called Liberalism, 1911, and he says, Liberalism is the liberation of living spiritual energy. And I think your comment there, you know, we started the conversation on Peruvian peasants and a sense of freedom, which gave them that step up, you know, socioeconomically. And you are such an inspiration to me. I am so honored you've spent this time with me. And whatever we can do to support you and to learn from you, we're deeply, deeply honored.
Well, you are very kind, Victor, and it was a great conversation, and we should have another one after the election.
I look forward to that. I shall let's make it a promise. Perhaps the new year will be the best time.
Perfect. Okay. And let's hope it's an optimistic start to the new year.
Oh, well, if no one else can do it, you and I will. Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation. You can imagine I find Carol and her work inspiring and provides an intellectual underpinning for the work we do in optimism, promoting optimism, modeling optimism, and helping people learn those tips and tricks, which, as Carol said, is so important to building a better country and a better world. Best wishes for a great day.